A surprising number of NFL players have come out of the small town of Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. But when the steel mills closed in the 2000s, the community went to an economic decline, followed by a spike in drugs and crime. S.L. Price's new book, called Playing Through the Whistle, Steel Football in an American Town, is published by Grove Atlantic. He is a senior journalist at Sports Illustrated, and I'm very pleased to welcome Scott Price to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
How many immigrants came to Aliquippa in the early 20th century, and where did they come from?
Well, they came mostly from Eastern Europe, but all over Europe and the Ukraine, Czechoslovakia, the Balkans, Poland, some from Ireland. And there was about, the number kept growing, but it at its peak, the town was up to 30,000.
And that's because it had lots of jobs?
Well, what happened was Jones and Laughlin, the steel company, expanded and needed to expand its operations. It was constrained in Pittsburgh. They went downriver on the Ohio River and basically bought the property on an old amusement park was Aliquippa, what would become Aliquippa, and they designed the town. It was a company town. There were some utopian feelings about we're going to make the most beautiful steel town ever, divided it into 12 plans. Each plan was a different ethnic group. Part of that was self-serving. You can sort of get in the way of union organizing if people are separated and don't speak the same language. And at the same time, or at least soon after that, in the decades after World War I, then the Great Migration of blacks from up south came up. So it was a great mix and the ultimate melting pot.
Did everyone get along?
No. I mean,
and they were kind of divided by class and ethnicity and race.
Absolutely.
Consciously.
Absolutely. And like I said, part of it was by design. This was pretty much a de facto police state. The utopian impulse gave way fairly quickly to a real understanding that J&L wanted to control the town, and keeping the ethnic groups separate was part of that, and somewhat hostile. Blacks had the worst jobs in the mill, and it was a cause of great resentment. There was no advancement per se.
And there were tunnels in the mill. How did that work?
Well, no, there was a tunnel that goes from downtown, mm-hmm. and it was very much known as the sort of entrance to the mill was at the end of the downtown, end of Franklin Avenue. And you basically would take a right to go to the South Mills and left to go to the North Mills. And you essentially were, it was the gateway. And that's where, for example, the wives of the men in the early days would wait for their men to come because they were paid in a combination of cash and scrip, and to make sure their men did not drink away their earnings on the three dozen bars on Franklin Avenue, they would kind of hijack and waylay their husbands.
How many people worked there at J&L at its peak?
At its height, it was around 14,000.
And did they own the steel mill until its collapse in the 2000s?
No, it actually was sold off. Jones and Laughlin was sold to LTV Corporation. A gentleman named James Ling came in, and he was involved in lots of different operations. It was a conglomerate corporation that sort of assumed the steel mill. But essentially, it was always known as J&L. And what happened was in the 50s, once labor organizing became a thing established in society.
The Steel Workers Union was one of the strongest unions in the country.
Absolutely, and essentially J&L became finally very paternalistic and is to this day well regarded by many people as an operation that actually tried to help the town.
Well, when you say paternalistic, at one point there were a lot of young people working there. They almost had to be the parents of these kids.
Yeah, no, it was an extraordinary. It really was daddy in town, and it did, you know, until the will of the company was broken in the 30s. It did rule the town with an iron fist.
What about injuries? Did they take care of the all the people who got hurt?
Well, up until union protections really kicked in the late 30s, early 40s, and then especially in the 50s, no, there were deaths, there were lost fingers, there were lost limbs, there were men to this day who can't breathe. The asbestos was in the factory, and they're still paying, you know, getting paid for the injuries that were done them. People lost limbs. There was there's a sort of myth or legend that essentially is when someone fell into the pool of molten ore by mistake, they would cut the ladle and bury him whole in the ladle in the ground there. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Now, this is a part of Pennsylvania that has produced some pretty great football players. When was the football program created for the Aliquippa High School?
Well, it was created in, you know, essentially 10, 11, then there was a couple years off, and essentially 14, 15 was when it really began. But they were, you know, sort of a they weren't very good, let's put it that way, for years. But pretty quickly what happened was you did have these ethnic groups and the blacks and whites separated in almost every sort of iteration in town. But when it came to sports, all the different neighborhoods funneled through individual elementary schools and junior high, but eventually would filter completely all the groups into Aliquippa High. And if you played sports for Aliquippa High, a lot of those ethnic tensions remained, but they were superseded by you better win this game and you better beat up, you know, Butler or whomever the arch rival, Hopewell or anybody else who's surrounding.
Who's Carl A. Ashman, and why is the stadium named after him?
Carl Ashman was the, if there's a Vince Lombardi figure for this town, he was the original hard-nosed football coach. He came in the 40s and basically set the tone for this sort of 3 yards and a cloud of dust style of football. He was a strict disciplinarian, and he was the guy who essentially made Mike Ditka as a tight end and really sort of formed the entire superstructure of what Aliquippa football is.
And he was the first to make it big and go on to have a really big career in the
yep.
National Football League. When did he start playing for the high school team?
Mike played in 50. He played on the 55 team, I believe that's right. I'm blanking a little bit, but he was, and that was the championship team. But Mike played 2 years before that, and he was kind of scrawny. He was not a big guy. He was not a great player until his senior year. Then he was doing push-ups in his house and running all over town. And he played with such a fire and intensity in his senior year. He suddenly blossomed his incredible talent.
Was that intensity the result of his upbringing?
Well, his dad, Little Mike, as he was known in town, was a very intense guy, was not shy about physically disciplining Mike, and Mike resented it, that's for sure. And Mike hints that also he wasn't shy about just laying a hand on Mrs. Ditka as well. But and in later years, Mike will say, well, that, you know, I didn't like it. And in fact, at one point he said, Mom, I want to make millions of dollars and get a nice car, but Dad can't ride in it. I don't want Dad to ever be able to ride in it. And he absolutely ruled with an iron fist in that town. They had to go to bed. Mike had to go to bed by, you know, 7:30 at night, and he was brought up very strictly. And essentially but that intensity was not born out of sort of our classic idea of, well, he grew up poor. Actually, he was quite a comfortable working class upbringing.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that these guys all became football players because they didn't want to work in the mills. Was that true?
To a certain extent, yes. And what I mean is there very much was the impulse in the families of, I'm working in this mill so you don't have to. And I can't tell you how many people told me, my dad brought me down there in the summertime and I'd come home from school or from college and I'd say, yeah, maybe I can work in the mill. And their parents would go in and tell their bosses, make sure you give my son the worst job ever. So and football was used not to get to the NFL, but to get to college. And Ditka, you know, much to the hilarity of everybody who lives in Aliquippa, wanted to be a dentist and was going to Pitt to be a dentist. And everybody says, can you imagine, you know, Mike having those meat hooks in your mouth? And if you possibly complain, he'd deck you. I mean, you know.
Well, he'd knock your teeth out first, right. And then he'd give you the pulse.
Then he'd fix them. No, so, but it was very much the means to an end, which was you're going to get an education. And a lot of people went off to Division I schools.
I'm speaking to S.L. Price. His book, Playing Through the Whistle, Steel, Football, and an American Town. Not just football, Pistol Pete Maravich, one of the greatest basketball players to ever live, came from this town. Did other basketball players come out of it?
Yeah, but none of the renown of Pete. I mean, Pete left at 13. His dad, Press Maravich, is a famous college basketball coach, and Pete moved off with his dad to Raleigh, North Carolina. And in fact, Ditka told me a story that Pete would come. Ditka played basketball also, and when he missed a shot, he broke his hand punching a wall, and he said that little guy, expletive, Pete, would come in. He was 5, 6, 7 years old, and he was better than all of us, and so I mean, this town again not only had great basketball players, but Henry Mancini is from there. Madonna's father, Jesse Steinfeld, the Surgeon General, who was fired by Richard Nixon, the first black president of the NCAA. It's an incredible lineup.
And when did African Americans start moving into the area?
Essentially, after World War I, when the Great Migration of blacks coming up to northern cities began, there were wages, there were jobs, and where there were jobs, people followed, and that's the stream started then.
Although integration wasn't an easy transition.
No, and it really was. I mean, right from the start, blacks in the steel mill had, like I said, the worst jobs, the lowest pay, and the least chance of advancement.
And you write that black students were only allowed in white communities during school hours. If they were around with the wrong crowd, they could get hurt, and it also worked the other way too. Whites could be hurt because of tensions with a bunch of black kids.
Absolutely, and it really came to a head in the 70s when look, there was racial tension across the country, but in Aliquippa there were race riots in the streets. The schools shut down for a period of time, and a junior high school teacher, Melvin Steeles, was accused of fomenting rioting in the streets when he took kids to a movie. And in the midst of those riots, he and his twin brother wrote a very famous pop standard, Could It Be We're Fallen in Love, which is a song that a lot of people know from the early 70s. So even amidst these sort of terrible, difficult times, some true beauty emerged from there as well.
Did things ease up when the school started producing some really famous black athletes?
Yes, and not only that.
I'd imagine they're very proud of Tony Dorsett, for example.
Well, Dorsett, no.
Although he didn't go to Alabama.
Dorsett's the one who got away. Yeah. Dorsett's the one who, because of the racial problems, I mean, his family had a tradition of going to Hopewell, which is 3 miles away, Hopewell High. But because of the racial division in town, Aliquippa football was terrible at the time Dorsett played. And the famous coach Don Yanessa told me of Aliquippa, who came in right after Tony's career essentially was over at Hopewell, if I had come in, I would have stolen Tony away. There's no question we would, because I stole their players all the time, is what he said to me. And so, but what really happened in 78 is that the football team led the town in healing a lot of that racial rift. It was falling apart in many ways. The quarterback clubs were split racially. There was one black, one white. The crowds split racially. They did not sit together. The team was split racially. And finally, Dan Peepshort and Sherman McBride, who are both respectively the defensive and offensive coordinators today, they were playing then, and they came in and said, that's it. If you're not with us, you're against us, to the rest of the players. And basically, the team came together, and after that, the town followed suit.
It continued to produce great players until recently. The Jets cornerback Darrell Revis grew up in the area.
Yeah,
but he was a bystander in a shooting. What happened?
Yeah, he was. He was up in on a street in a dodgy neighborhood in Aliquippa, going to buy some shoes. Came home from Pitt, where he was a sophomore playing football there, and already established as a great player. And he came home one day and was going into this store, saw a friend of his, and all of a sudden a car went by and out came the guns, and it was broad daylight. He dove into what essentially is a gutter in between the wheel well of a car to get away, and luckily went unhurt. But he played on the 2003 state championship team, and there are now at least seven people who've died from that team since then, and the eighth was the quarterback, Savante Gilliam, a two-time Purple Heart winner, who was found dead in Aliquippa this summer.
All because of the growth of drugs and crime in the area?
Yeah.
Why Pittsburgh has transitioned into a new economy? Couldn't that have happened in Aliquippa?
You know, it's a very difficult – Aliquippa stands for a lot of these company towns and a lot of these river towns that are – they don't have the resources of the university systems to sell, like University of Pittsburgh or Carnegie Mellon, and healthcare and other industries and the bones of a beautiful town to sort of attract young up-and-comers and industries. These towns were built for one reason, and when the steel mill or the company town and this any other company in any other state leaves, it truly hollows out the town. And the problem now, of course, is that you put the exact same steel mill there, what once employed 14,000 is going to employ maybe 800 because of mechanization and modern uses of machinery.
Has anyone counted up all the NFL players who came out of this town? It sounds like it probably produced more good players than any other community of its size.
I don't know the exact number of NFL players, but I would tell you that, you know, it's from Ditka to Darrell Revis to Ty Law, Sean Gilbert, and then a slew of Division I-A players, per capita, there's no other place like it.
Has the city started to show any signs of improvement recently?
I mean, they have a mayor, a former player from the team, Dwan Walker, who's doing everything he can. But this is truly Aliquippa is essentially a rhapsody on about work. I mean, this is a town that was built on work and thrived on work and was proud of work, and football was an extension of that. And what has happened now is the loss of work.
What
and
happened to Dwan Walker's sister, the mayor's sister?
Dwan Walker's sister was killed by in a murder suicide by her boyfriend while her son watched and saw it happen, and because of that, Dwan Walker ran for mayor and won and became the first black mayor in Aliquippa to try and essentially save his town.
Now, we mentioned Tony Dorsett growing up there. His brother got involved in drug activities.
Yep. Yeah. And I will tell you, I mean, Tony's brother got involved. I mentioned Sherman McBride earlier. Sherman McBride, the offensive coordinator of the team today, his brother Grover lost his job in the steel mill, had never been in any kind of trouble, but along with the residue and the damage of that shutdown, along with suicides, divorces, and so on and so forth, sent people, quote unquote, into the pharmaceutical trade, as Sher McBride said. And Sher McBride's brother was arrested by his defensive coordinator today, Dan Peep Short, and they're still best friends.
Scott Price, who writes under the byline S.L. Price, is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, has been there since 1994, and he's the author of three previous books, Heart of the Game, Pitching Around Fidel, which was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and Far Afield. His most recent is Playing Through the Whistle, Steel, Football, and American Town, published by Grove Atlantic. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.